Hey everyone, this is Patrick Barney, one of the Book Spider hosts, here to offer an editor's note before we get into the episode proper. Unfortunately, 5 or 6 of our episodes are currently stuck in technical limbo. That means we'll be publishing episodes out of order for a little bit, starting with this one on some important questions in the philosophy of literature. Thanks for your patience and understanding, and now on to the show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Book Spider Podcast. I'm Patrick Barney. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. Usually, Book Spider is a Book of the Week style program, meaning that we would normally discuss a novel, a play, a collection of poems, or some other piece of literature that one of us has chosen. However, this time around, I've decided to, exercise the sadist in me because I want to see my co-host squeal around as we discuss 3 important questions in the philosophy of literature. These are, can literature reveal or even contain truth? What is the relationship between literature and morality? And finally, do we need to consider an author's intentions when trying to figure out the meaning of a text? To facilitate this discussion, we've read Aristotle's Poetics, which founded philosophy of literature as a discipline. We've also read the first chapter of Peter Lamarck's The Philosophy of Literature, which offers some important definitions in the discipline, and kind of delineates the boundary between philosophy of literature and literary criticism. And we've also read 3 scholarly articles, each dealing with one of the questions I've just posed. In Defense of Literary Truth, Paolo Pittari argues in respected disagreement with Peter Lamarck and Stein Holgum Olsen that literary value is impossible without some form of literary truth. In Moderate Moralism, Noel Carroll argues that not only does literature deal with moral issues can also be aesthetic issues. Then lastly, in Art, Intention, and Conversation, also by Noel Carroll, the claim is made that we should think about an author's intentions when determining the meaning of a text, because, like any form of linguistic communication, meaning is impossible without intention. So, let's get into the nitty-gritty of these questions. First, I want to know, what do you guys think? Are you pro-truth or no-truth in regards to literature, as Pittari has defined the terms in Defense of Literary Truth?
Well, I'm hoping we can talk about those terms a little bit and kind of the different ways that Pittari is categorizing truth. So by my count, like maybe the important ones are like literary truth as sort of like the overall concept, mimetic truth, metaphorical truth, and I don't know that I have enough of a clean grasp of what those are. I grok the kind of vaguely the concept of no truth versus truth as a whole, but I'm wondering if either of you could sort of weigh in on like what your understandings were of, those different steps that Pittari is taking in this essay of sort of talking about those different like angles on truth.
So discussing the literary truth versus mimetic truth. So mimesis is basically the truth of imitation, right? So the idea that literature should hold a mirror up to reality and reflect reality faithfulness to facts. So, and that the idea of mimesis does go back to Aristotle's Poetics. Aristotle is the guy who said that, literature needs to do this. There has been a lot of dissent from that position and some probable misunderstanding of that position. But probably what it boils down to is just the idea that literature should remain faithful to the facts. And I would say that I think that Pitari, he this is what he writes on, this is like page 2. He says, if literary mimesis is imitation or verisimilitude, then literary truth is always something less than actual truth. There is no denying that. The imitation of the truth cannot be the truth. So, that's what he starts his article off with. Does that make sense to you, Chris?
Sorry. When we say faithfulness to the facts, maybe this is going to be a really dumb question. Is that something like if you're reading Hunt for the Red October and Tom Clancy has really done his research about the details of how a Soviet submarine works? Is that the type mm-hmm. of faithfulness to the facts that we mean here? Like just adhering carefully to real world correspondences?
Not exactly. So if you guys remember from the Poetics, Aristotle, you know, he's the one who uses mimesis, and he's removed a little bit from a lot of these plays that he's talking about. So Aristotle doesn't have any literal belief in gods or Zeus or anything like that. But he totally accepts that within Homer, that that the gods should be present as characters because they were part of the worldview of Homer. So it's not necessarily that we have to represent everything accurately, but that we have to represent everything accurately to the worldviews and situations that are within the work. So in the case of Tom Clancy, yeah, we would need to faithfully represent, you know, how a submarine of the time of the Hunt for Red October functions, right?
So wait, I'm trying to draw a correspondence here. So if the argument is that something written about Homeric times should include those gods because they're part of the worldview of the characters, does that mean that like Tom Clancy should include Jesus as a character because Christianity is part of the worldview of Reaganite America?
No. Maybe I shouldn't have used the word should. Just that if we represent Homeric times as Homer does, mm-hmm. It's perfectly acceptable to include gods as characters because gods to the people in that time would have been like real things that, you know, real characters. So not necessarily that you have to, but that you can, and it is perfectly within mimetic truth to do so.
But to some extent, you're obligated by, you know, truth to like exhibit like what, like if like basically like, is there a saturation point to which like the Greek gods are present in the zeitgeist of the of that time where you're kind of obligated to sort of speak through them, or is it always an option? I don't know if that makes sense. Like, are you obligated to reflect certain things in order to adhere to truth?
I would say that's probably a spectrum. There's a spectrum of like where we could represent gods within the action and, you know, be hitting it at the right spot. And then in other ways we might overdo it or underdo it. So that's probably more of a, like, is the artist doing it well to type thing.
I guess I still don't. Can you give me an example of how you would evaluate mimetic truth other than Homer and the gods? How would you evaluate mimetic truth in, I don't know, what's a book that we've read for the podcast?
Let's talk about Moby Dick. That seems like a pretty relevant book, right?
Sure. And it's been it was invoked by Carol as well. So
right.
Point of comparison. Okay, how do you evaluate mimetic truth?
Could you give a summary of Moby Dick first?
You fuck.
I probably could give a reasonable summary. It's been a bit since I read it.
I'm joking.
But so, like, in a book about whaling that doesn't purport to be fantastical, and it is a realist novel, right? Would we say that Moby Dick is a realist novel?
Maybe.
It was inspired by, I think, a real, a real whale attacking ship situation.
So for Moby Dick to contain mimetic truth, we would say that we want its depiction of whaling to represent pretty well the practice of whaling at the time. Right. And then in the chapters where Melville just kind of goes off on whales for the fun of it, right, we would want that information to reflect the information that we have that would have been available at the time.
And is that, I guess, like, is that different from verisimilitude?
No, I don't think it is. I think that is verisimilitude. The point that Pitari is making, I think, here is that if literary mimesis is verisimilitude, then it's not really the same thing as truth, right? Because, you know, to be able to accurately represent whaling at the time, Melville would have had to have some experience on ships that had done whaling, or at least, you know, not necessarily have firsthand knowledge, but have enough knowledge about how it went that he could represent it pretty well. So the idea is that the actual truth is what actually happened, and then verisimilitude is just representing it in a way that people believe that it could have happened that way.
And Melville did have experience with ships, but basically, saying if he didn't, and he just did a very, like, who's the writer who wrote Master and Commander? O'Brien?
I don't know, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, they turned it into a movie, but it's actually a series of lots and lots of books about Captain Aubrey and his surgeon companion out fighting privateers. And I think that author never sailed in his life.
Right.
And so, but the verisimilitude is the mimetic truth is not, it's not mimicking reality. It's mimicking an understanding of that reality enough that people read it as true.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So, I mean, maybe like we like, I don't know if we go down other like pathways of defining these concepts, but like metaphorical truth.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what is that? This is very helpful for me, Patrick.
Okay, sure. So let's look at this section. So Lamarck and Olson, this is on page 3 at the bottom, Lamarck and Olson coherently deny all defenses of literary truth as metaphorical truth. They grant that conveying a determinate propositional content that expresses truth may be a context-specific aim of metaphor, but they submit that this is not the constitutive aim of speaking metaphorically. So when we think of like trying to describe something with a metaphor, so it could be really simple, war is hell, right? So when there's truth in that, if we accept that hell is full of suffering, and we also accept that war is full of suffering, then it's a very truthful description. War is full of suffering, just like hell is full of suffering. So, and I think that's fine. I think that's perfectly acceptable way to think of metaphorical truth. Lamarck and Olson deny that context-specific truth, which they say is what a metaphor is, like it's a truth, but it's very specific to a context. They deny that that's an important type of truth. They say it's likely to be a low-key truth. And then Pitari responds, well, maybe, but it's still true. So yeah. your argument's not super good. Does that make sense?
I do. That does make sense. And it also, like, it seems like kind of, it seems pretty complicated to me to sort of say that, to define where context actually becomes necessary. It feels like context is necessary, like in all communication. Like, it's not really like when you start turning to metaphor or anything like that, that suddenly, like, you need to understand what that meant at the time.
Right.
Basically, if you zoom out far enough, like, the context goes away for everything.
Everything.
So, like, yeah, I think that, and this helps me kind of answer that question. I think I'm pro truth.
Oh, all right, sure.
In part because I definitely believe that that there is truth that is unveiled through metaphor, through the act of basically like drawing those connections between understandings of things like war and hell. That is, you know, if not reflective of an existing truth, at least creating a shared understanding of what is true. And I do believe that.
Yeah. And I agree too. I think that obviously metaphors make connections between two things in such a way as the person reading the metaphor can see what's similar about them. And that's absolutely a form of truth. 100%. So, as you were saying, Chris, I do think that metaphorical truth is a perfectly reasonable type of truth that literature has. Mimetic truth may not be as rigorous a type of truth that literature has, since it's not like, you know, in Moby Dick, Melville didn't discover anything about whales so much. He just kind of reported and represented true things. So maybe that's, you know, to the truth purist, maybe that's a little less than truth. But the next kind of truth that Pitari mentions is the subjective knowledge theory of cognitive value. And I think this is a pretty strong candidate, especially when we look at something like a novel that I know we all respect, which is Lost Memory of Skin. And that's the type of the subjective knowledge theory of cognitive value is the type of truth that I would think that the Lost Memory of Skin most obviously provides and seems extremely beneficial. So, like, it's the knowledge of what it is like to be in a certain situation, to be a certain type of person, a certain type of situation. Would you guys you guys want to like flesh that idea out a little more? You think you understand it? Should we continue on, or is there more to say about this one?
No, I understand that one quite well, actually. And that one, I mean, that's the one that I would reach for intuitively. It's the one I would have reached for intuitively before I read the essay. And it's the one that seems to me to be the area where, well, I guess I have a bit of an ingrained habit of essentially treating prose fiction and literature as almost indistinguishable terms, which is right. unfair to many other art forms. But I mean, I'm, you know, personally very attached to prose fiction. It's kind of my thing. And that's, I think, to the extent that you can make a kind of utilitarian case for the social benefit of prose fiction, I think that's the strongest right. area in which it can be done. And just kind of the most, also at the same time, the most kind of subjectively moving means of experiencing it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I believe, Hans, you picked out a pretty good quote from Pitari that says, questions concerning the ontology of literary fiction and literary value remain open. Meanwhile, however, readers continue to read in the belief that literature is profound and true in exploring the depths of human nature and can teach something significant about ourselves and the world. So it seems like
this seems most closely related to that form of truth. And that's a quote right. from near the end of the essay. So it seems to me like he's privileging that form of truth a bit himself.
Right. Now, the next kind of truth that Pitari mentions is literature as moral philosophy. And it seems like this is pretty straightforward. It seems like we go into more detail into this concept with Noel Carroll's moderate moralism, but it seems like both Pitari and Carroll are in agreement that it does seem like literature can do some form of moral education in that it can provide a space. This is what Pitari says. Literature can provide a space for conversing about our deepest concerns, including moral ones. In this deepest sense, literature is a kind of moral philosophy, and the contribution it offers is specific to its form. Now, I wonder, this one is interesting to me because certainly, like when we let's go back to Homer again. Certainly, when we read the Iliad or the Odyssey, we encounter a totally different moral world, right? But it does seem that we learn what the moral world is like from reading about the Iliad, at least a little bit. Agree or disagree with that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, is that different from, that seems almost to have more of an anthropological function, right? I mean, is there a distinction between exploring moral philosophy in ways that actually affect our daily lives versus observing the moral philosophy of a very removed people? Because if there's any flaw to this type of truth, I think it's probably that the nature of morality is such that it's constantly evolving, and that if we're not treating it in more of an anthropological way, then it becomes, part of the idea of literature is that it should have at least somewhat of a timeless quality, right? That it should capture human experience in a way that, like, there's something about the humanity of Shakespeare's characters that resonates with us and feels authentic, perhaps in the way of the last type of truth we were talking about, even though, again, like, their moral world is so far removed from us.
Right.
And I think, like, this, because morality changes almost in the way that kind of genetic drift changes, you know, the DNA of an organism. This creates a kind of datedness for literature that seems to me to undermine its value a bit.
Well, and that's why, like, I wonder, again, when we read something like the Iliad or the Odyssey, on the one hand, we come into contact with a completely different moral world. But I wonder, so we read the Odyssey for this podcast, and I'm wondering if you guys felt like there were any moral questions that it asked that are still worth talking about today. And I would say if there are any moral questions that something ancient like the Odyssey asks that we still think about, then that might be a candidate for this moral education or moral literature as moral philosophy that we're talking about. And if not, this might be an area where we would say, well, maybe literature as moral philosophy isn't related to the truth that much.
I think, I don't know if this is helpful, but I think that like a narrative that is entirely alien in terms of its morals would not be digestible.
Sure.
I don't think that basically we see like the Odyssey or I just recently read Gilgamesh as being, you know, really, really different. Really different worlds, really different philosophies, by, you know, a more, you know, I guess like kind of consistency with like can more those older we'll go to the Odyssey. I'm not going to talk about the Odyssey and the Gilgamesh together, but you know, like it's a more overtly, explicitly patriarchal society. It's a more overtly, explicitly, you know, warlike representation, at least of a culture, and yet, you know, it's, you know, the Odyssey is a father-son story. It's about you know, someone coming home. You know, I they're like underlying grand narratives and sort of moral positions relative to, you know, how people position themselves in those stories that I think still resonate with us today. And right. That's what makes it readable. Like if there's something that's entirely alien, if there's nothing in it that resonates with our morals today or our values, I don't think that like I don't think that it stays in the canon. I think it goes away.
Yeah.
Is that possible? Can there be I guess there could be. I was going to ask if there could be. I mean, I feel like my instinct is to think that there's enough commonality in human experience throthroughout time, across culture, that almost nothing would be entirely alien. It might have aspects that are off-putting enough to make it alienating, but nothing would be morally entirely alien. But maybe that's not true. I mean, maybe triumph of the will is entirely alien, you know, from a moral standpoint. That's a film and not a text. But
I think, yeah, if we might be, you know, kind of, we might be kind of trapped within sample size here, right? Like there's not actually a broad enough sample of like stories, narratives, morals to sort of really give us a spectrum to test this against, because we're all writing from within a relatively comparable experience, even across all time. Like we just are, you know, we're not able to test this against suitably alien morals.
I guess it does seem to me like if, well, it just, I don't think that it's impossible that there could be, for instance, moral questions raised by the Odyssey that might still resonate today. I do wonder if there aren't just ultimately better tools for the exploration of morals than than literature, particularly literature that's not entirely contemporary.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, I definitely think that's an interesting viewpoint, and I know that in another book I've read, I forget whether it was called What is Literature For or What is Fiction For, but the author made that exact same point, Hans. He said that, you know, literature may not be the best medium for the exploration of morals or philosophy in general. Mm-hmm. Though he did, like, he basically what he said is that literature can be philosophical,
right,
while the writer is not necessarily a philosopher. If that distinction makes sense. And I feel like maybe that's something similar to what you're saying now.
Well, and I think of morals as being, morals involve generalities, right? Morals, and maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think of morals as involving principles which are to be, the morals involve broad principles, right? Morals involve principles for how to live. And fiction is most interesting, literature is most interesting when it most fully develops a character in an individual way, right? It seems to me like there's a kind of fundamental tension between the generality of moral consideration and the specificity of fictional representation or of characterization, right? I mean, if we, I don't know, I'm having trouble thinking of textual examples today and not film and television, right? But like,
I mean, it's fine, sure.
But, you know, there, you, something like Mad Men, right? Like, there's a whole kind of set of moral ideas about how you should behave in the realms of sex and gender. But watching the ways that individual circumstance compel an individual to act differently, that's interesting, right? Or you mentioned Lost Memory of Skin, right? Like, there's, if the point of Lost Memory of Skin was to explore whether or not it's moral to try to arrange a hookup with a 14-year-old girl on the internet, that would be very different from the novel that actually is, which is much more about A, the kind of set of subjective circumstances that leads someone to disregard that moral, and B, how to think more empathetically about the experience of that person. Now, I guess you could argue that there's maybe a different set of moral questions in Lost Memory of Skin, right? The moral question of, like, as a society, how do you balance justice and mercy for people who are sexually deviant, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe that book is actually a valuable tool for considering that. But in a way, I think, like, the moral questioning in Lost Memory of Skin happens, I think, secondarily maybe to the way that it gets at the truth of subjective mind states, or whatever the term is that you used for the last type of truth.
Subjective knowledge theory of cognitive value.
Subjective knowledge theory of cognitive value. It just seems to me like subjective knowledge theory of cognitive value is something that literature does specifically the best.
Yeah, and
consideration of morality is something that a lot of other tools and mediums do maybe more effectively.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree with that.
Yeah.
100%. Like, I definitely think of the types of truth that we're talking about, I think the subjective knowledge theory is, like, literature spot on, and like, that's what literature does, and it's super important. So the final kind of theory, kind of truth that we're talking about is the propositional theory of truth. And basically, you know, a proposition is in philosophy, it's just any statement that could have truth value, like if X and Y, then Z. We have X and Y, so Z, right? If that makes sense. So, you know, this is, in this area, Lamarck and Olson say that with the propositional theory, literature gets into trouble. This is on page 6. Not when it affirms that literature presents true or false claims, but when it states that the truth value of these claims determines a work's literary value. So they're saying that the truth or falsity of a proposition within literature doesn't make it valuable. And then Pittari says things like, you know, points out that if Middlemarch doesn't deal with the problem of free will and determinism as well as it does, then we're less interested in it. And then Pittari also points out some works that where the literary value of certain works seems to have fallen away because the questions that the literary work was asking and addressing have kind of been answered and they're no longer important. So I feel like that's pretty straightforward. Like, do we understand the propositional theory of literary truth? Like, do we know what that means?
Yeah, and it brings up a thing that I've kind of broadly between a lot of these articles, it seems like what the sort of philosophy, the tension in philosophy around truth or non-truth, intentionalism, non-intentionalism, moralism, non-moralism, is kind of sort of circling like this question of whether it works, like not the question of whether it works or not, but basically like if morals are relevant to the story, then the morals are relevant to the story. If understanding the author's intent is relevant to appreciating the text itself, then authorial intent is, you know, then it's relevant. You know, if there is some sort of you know, if you're able to sort of like let's say like lost memory of skin, if people in the sort of legally exiled pedophile community were to say, yes, this really does capture our, you know, our position, our perspective, it is a truth, it's representative of us, even if the author isn't, you know, from that community, then that's an evidence of truth. There's something in here that's sort of like, there's something in all of these that's like kind of returning to a real simple, if it works, it works, right? Mm-hmm. Like basically like with Middlemarch, as you were saying, like, you know, the fact that it does work means that it works, means that it's true. And, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering, I don't know, like that just seems to be a pattern between, you know, a lot of these pieces and the sort of internal tensions. And is that reflective of some kind of, I'm not sure, it feels like there's something that Lamarck is fighting against that it does seem a little bit like, it seems pretty self-evident and simple in a lot of these cases to return to, you know, if it works, it works. Is that a wrong interpretation?
No, I mean, I definitely agree that I think that, like, when we look at these types of truth, you know, metaphorical truth or subjective knowledge theory, Lamarck is, you know, he dislikes saying that literature can be true in these ways, even though to me, and I think to you too, it seems pretty obvious that literature can be true in at least some of these ways. Like maybe as far as morals is concerned, we're not so sure, but as far as like metaphorical truth and subjective knowledge theory, it seems pretty clear that literature can contain these types of truth. And I guess all I can say is that, you know, Lamarck is at least part of a pretty big vein within the philosophical and literary critical tradition that is skeptical of truth in literature. You know, seems like from my memory, it seems like most of the critics that you know one encounters in the big names are all like anti-truth, right? Roland Barthes, Jacques Lacan, Foucault, these people are all anti-truth. Now I don't know exactly why they're strenuously anti-truth, when it seems pretty clear to me that there's no reason to be.
Can I hazard I feel like taking disentangling text from truth basically frees up your analysis and the different ways in which you want to use that text.
Well, sure, yeah.
Because truth is an anchor, right? Truth is something that like basically truth is a kind of a tautological test, like and it's sort of outside of the it's outside of the will and lenses. It sort of it fights against, you know, the twisting, turning, dismantling, reconstructing, you know, critical process. And I think that
absolutely
those that you named all want to do very different things with texts than to just ascertain whether they one accurately represented, you know, this or that, you know, a demographic, or two, were particularly clever in how they metaphorically explored, you know, this or that, you know, concept. I think that they want to do different things with it.
Is that, but I guess, and part of my motivation for like wanting to talk about this issue is to ask if that's acceptable though. So in Art, Conversation, and Intention, the article about Art, Intention, and Conversation, Carol brings up the idea of like reinterpreting Ed Wood as a postmodern auteur, right? And so I'm wondering what you guys think about this. I know where I stand. You know, I think that reinterpreting Ed Wood as a postmodern auteur is dishonest, and well, maybe not dishonest. Like you could reasonably point out that he wasn't an auteur, but treat him as one, and you know, treat his work as if it's doing something important. But it seems to me like if you do that, you are doing epistemological damage. So that's my take. And I'm wondering like what you guys think. Like, is it like, so Roland Barthes says, you know, the author is dead, so now we can just do whatever we want with the text. Let's interpret it how we want. Is that good or bad? if we all agree that literature does contain some truths, is it good or bad to kill the author?
Well, I think that you can. I think if you're responsible about it, I think you can maintain, or I think you can practice both approaches in ways that aren't necessarily intention or exclusion, right? I mean, I think you can evaluate Ed Wood's work within postmodern auteur theory while also still having some understanding of his actual biography and the relationship of his intention to the work, right? Sure. I don't think that those are actually, the use of one lens doesn't mean that you can't transition to the other lens. I do think it's, for a fully rounded understanding of the work, I think it's important that, you know, the culture as a whole retains that memory, I guess. I mean, if you're going to have people, treating Ed Wood as a postmodern auteur, it's good that, you know, the film biography of Ed Wood by Tim Burton also exists, right? Which is more of kind of a, it approaches his life in a more conventionally biographical way, where the circumstance of the creation is so important to the outcome of the work. I mean, I don't think either of those. I think that it's, as long as the kind of memory of the culture as a whole retains both those things, it's okay to practice death of the author criticism. And I think that, if anything, I think like most, one thing that I've found from teaching an intro to writing about literature class is that most people who are not steeped in academia are very inclined to, in fact, default toward author intention focused or biographically focused criticism and intention and biographical ways of understanding any given text, right? And so I think like there's a kind of natural, like the tilt of the whole kind of world at large is toward that sort of thinking. Where, you know, knowing about the life of Emily Dickinson is helpful and important to understanding the emotional tenor of the poems, right? And so because the world as a whole and just something about human nature, at least as it exists within any culture that I come into contact with, because those things kind of have a natural gravity in favor of life of the author focused criticism. I don't think there's anything wrong with actually being fairly strenuous about death of the author focused criticism, just as a way of freeing, you know, keeping some amount of space for other types of thought, really. I think about this in relationship as an author, actually, to my own novel, right? Because I, without getting too spoilery, and on the assumption that no one who could possibly listen to this will have read my novel, there's a major decision that a main character makes at the end of my novel. And when I wrote it, I didn't understand why she did that. And it didn't bother me that I didn't understand why she did that, because I was writing in a mode where I was very instinctive and intuitive, and to some extent just wanted to get the fucking thing done. But a couple of people later explained her motivation to me in ways which now make sense and have become how I think about that character's motivation, right?
Sure.
One of two things was happening, though. Either I was subconsciously considering that character's motivation at a way below my own conscious access when I wrote it, and it was there, but I didn't know it was there. Or it was kind of an empty space and somebody else put a meaning in, which I have now fixed onto. And neither of those is necessarily compatible with a total pedestalization of author intention.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah, I'm pretty in favor of the right to kill the author, in part because I don't want to have to give a shit. I feel like I'm obligated to give a shit about the author's intentions. I think that the difference between a novel, say, and an email, like we're kind of talking about the relationship between, you know, normal human communication and needing to sort of understand the context in which, in order to, you know, act upon the email or, you know, respond to it accurately. The difference is that a novel is written to exist. It's basically an object that is attempting to be as self-contained as possible. Like that's kind of, I think, baked into a novel, a collection of poetry. They're teaching you how to read them and how to understand them while you're reading them. And context is always necessary. That's the thing. There's a kind of a slippery slope, like, allergy here in these philosophers where, like, well, if it isn't that all the way, then it can't be that at all, you know? And it's like, that's bullshit. I mean, like, you know, like there's some,
That is something that's real in analytic philosophy. Like,
yeah. Well, I think some context is needed and some context is optional, and author intent is optional. Like, I think that it can be used to unlock new understandings of the text. It can correct false understandings of the text. But it's also entirely, like, it's not okay to draw conclusions about Ed Wood through a false sort of understanding of, through an intentionally sort of like skewed understanding of his work. But I think it's interesting to explore work through a kind of skewed lens and see what comes of it. I think that that's entirely valid.
Well, and certainly authors, creators, writers say things about their own work all the time that are either obviously wrong or that limit its meaning in ways that almost do a violence to the text. And again, like, most of the examples I can think of are from other media, right? That aren't classically literature, but I don't know, like, this is maybe a silly example, but I don't know how familiar you guys are with the album Tarkus by the band Emerson, Lake and Palmer. The cover of that album is a painting of a giant armadillo with tank treads.
Okay.
And there's an interview with the keyboardist, with the singer, Greg Lake, where he says something basically to the effect of, I told Keith Emerson that, you know, if we're going to have an album about a giant armadillo with tank treads, then I'm out. Like, who the fuck wants to sing a song about an armadillo with tank treads? That's stupid. And it's just kind of become received wisdom that the song Tarkus is literally about a giant armadillo with tank treads, based, from what I can tell, on, you know, Greg Lake saying that it is. And if you listen to the song, it is clearly not literally about a giant armadillo with tank treads. It's about, you know, war, right? And it's about human war between humans, spoken of in a human way. But there's this whole kind of set of memes and jokes and commentaries that are based on, you know, why did ELP write an album about an armadillo with tank treads when it's just an image that somebody painted, right? And that's kind of a silly example, but it, if you look for those, they're everywhere, right? There are many, 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 many examples. I think there are a couple examples that are cited in Carroll's essay of, you know, authors saying something that's wrong about their work. But he kind of makes it seem like an outlier or like a minor complicating factor, when to me it seems to actually be a huge complicating factor and a kind of fundamental aspect of considering almost any work. I think maybe like fiction is maybe an exception in that regard, because people who write fiction generally tend to be more articulate and analytical and good with that kind of thinking and speech. But, you know, people that do music, people that do more intuitive arts are just not particularly good. You know, I mean, you think about somebody like Eminem, right? Like the gulf between the level of articulacy and verbal creativity that Eminem has when he's rapping and how little he has when he's speaking as an individual, right? Like, and there's just so much of that everywhere that it renders author intention a very, very, very flawed instrument for ascertaining truth. And also, once again, often something that forecloses the meaning of texts, which could have a lot more space to mean if they were allowed to.
Well, I think, so you brought up hip hop. I mean, like, I want to kind of make sure I say this, you know, maybe more carefully than I said it before. I think that novels aspire to, in many cases, to a kind of self-contained integrity, fidelity system. They're like, you know, like they can function on their own in many cases, but I don't think that anything can entirely function without context. I think that context is always necessary. But there are novels, but it's a sliding scale. That's the thing that I wanted to make clear about my own position on it, which is that some texts really beg for you to understand the context in which it was written or sung. And the reason that occurred to me with hip hop is that a lot of hip hop is in constant dialogue with itself. Like Eminem specifically is talking about, you know, other hip hop artists, and you know, they're talking about him and they're in dialogue, and that does, despite what Hans is saying, actually kind of gesture toward author intention, because it is referencing context outside of itself. And I think just, you know, I think novels do that to differing degrees. Like, we were talking about, Moby Dick earlier, and Moby Dick directly references the science of cetology at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a kind of an invitation for external context there that, is, I think, a fair thing to latch onto if you're looking for, you know, we were talking about it earlier, ways for the text to sort of truly represent something in the real world, and to sort of like connect those two things. So I think that authorial intent is, you know, and this is maybe problematic for analytical philosophy, it's a sliding scale of importance depending on the text, depending on the, you know, avenue of inquiry. And it's, you know, not something that, I think that there can be crimes against epistemology, Patrick, throwing out authorial intent entirely, but that the things that occur to me as most problematic in the moment are when authorial intent is disregarded to construct an understanding of the text that is then leveraged again outside of the context of the novel, which is kind of like having your cake and eating it too, or saying like, I don't care about the context in which this was written in constructing this idea of this text. And now I'm going to then take that idea and then, study the context of the novel through that, and that seems problematic to me. That's where you'd say Ed Wood, you know, was just a sloppy, you know, kind of, he wasn't really concerned with making, you know, the his texts seem as cohesive as he was just sort of pumping out these, you know, crazy scenes and these crazy ideas. And that's that's not, it's not fair to say that, you know, because those seem to resonate with postmodernism, that he was a postmodernist.
That's super interesting. I think that my experience has been a little different, and is that's probably why I would say I'm on a different side of the spectrum than you guys probably are. Just to like kind of give an example, I remember teaching. I've taught a poem called Sleepwalker's Ballad by Federico Garcia Lorca a number of times in intro to lit and intro to composition classes. And it's this very dreamy, weird, surreal poem that repeats this image of a horse up on the mountain and a ship out to sea, over and over. And like, the first line is green, I want you green, or maybe green, I love you green, depending on the translator. But it's a very surreal poem. And whenever I hear students talk about it, they have no fucking clue what it's about. Okay, they don't have any idea. They just say things, right? And they just say things, and that's all right. That's fine. Like, without any background in the study of literature, when you encounter a poem like this, you aren't necessarily going to know what it means or know what it says. But if you do provide some context that is about from when the poem was written, and you think about who Federico Garcia Lorca was, he was a gay man who was actually executed during the Spanish Civil War for being gay, for being a gay dissident poet, right? If you provide that information, you start to see that the poem is, I'm not going to say 100% I know this, but I'm going to say probably the poem is probably about a Spanish policeman in that context who is part of a revolution, and it leads to violence and things like that.
I certainly think that it can be, in many cases, that kind of context and intention can be somewhere between important and indispensable in making sense of a text, right? And I think, Chris, your example of all the hip hop songs that are about this rapper being mad at that rapper, those are incomprehensible, right? Like, The Chronic is incomprehensible if you don't know the history of the formation of Death Row Records and Dr. Dre leaving NWA and who Eazy-E is and why he's a punk and all that, you know. And your example too, Patrick, makes sense. I think the drawback to that, from a certain standpoint, maybe from a certain careerist standpoint, the ultimate issue with that is that to some extent puts a logical endpoint on criticism, right? I mean,
that's fair.
If you structure meaning making as, you know, here I have the text and over here I have the key that unlocks the text, now I have unlocked the text with my key, if nothing else, like, once another academic has published an article about, hey, let's all be aware that, you know, Lorca was a gay dissident in the Spanish Civil War, and that probably informs this poem, it kind of forecloses horizons for making meaning, right? And I think from a purely pragmatic standpoint, from a more maybe cynical standpoint, one of the benefits of death of the author criticism, one of the benefits of any kind of criticism that opens up infinite frontiers for play and meaning making is it just allows more academics to publish articles, which then allow them to get tenure, right? It doesn't seem coincidental to me that the people who materially benefit from that are also advocates of it.
Sure.
And that's not, that doesn't invalidate it as a way of understanding things, but it does, leaving aside like careerist considerations, it does make it less, it just makes it less interesting the more that you create a hierarchy where that type of understanding is the most important way of thinking about a text, the less room that you give to allow the possibility of studying texts in ways that feels fresh and engaging. Maybe that's overstating the case.
No, I think that that's important, like keeping open ways in which, and ways to talk about texts that are fresh and engaging. That seems important to me. The only fear that I would voice here would be that if we worry too much about keeping things open, we end up spending our lives doing nothing. Like we literally just say bullshit about texts that isn't real and doesn't have any important, doesn't mean anything whatsoever, I suppose.
Or that ends up repeating the same movement. If you establish a niche in which I am a post-colonial critic, and then you spend your life finding the inevitable post-colonial angle on, well, here's how Ulysses is post-colonial, right? Here's how Lost Memory of Skin is post-colonial. Here's a post-colonial reading of The Sopranos, right? Like,
right.
It does become a... It maybe becomes less about a way of making meaning and discovering and more about kind of applying a process for, again, perhaps ultimately cynical reasons.
So I would just say that, like, if I'm on one side of the intentionalist spectrum from you guys, which maybe we're probably not, like, totally opposite ends, but I it seems to me that we both see the need for keeping interpretation open to some degree, but also keeping it closed to some degree.
They should be in tension. Like that's
well, and I think that there's, a bit of a market effect, right? Where one of the things that keeps that closed is ultimately a reading that is too absurd. Just doesn't land with the market of readers and thinkers. And, you know, I mean, if you do in fact try to publish a post-colonial reading of The Sopranos, presumably the foreclosure of that possibility is less because of abstract principles of criticism and more because at some point you start making something that resonates with an audience.
Interesting. Okay, well, I think we discussed a lot of what I'm interested in. We didn't actually talk about the article Moderate Moralism, but that seems okay. We certainly talked about the relationship between literature and morality. And so, you know, I feel pretty satisfied that we got some useful ideas discussed here. So, what do we... I think it's Chris. I think it's your turn. What do you want to read next?
So, I actually am going back to a little bit when we were picking our next piece based on, you know, what we're covering today.
Oh, cool.
And it's not theory, though, Patrick. Settle down. very far from it, in fact. But the other day, my father-in-law, who's visiting, said that the Cold War never ended, and I just saw this because I have one of his other books that I've read up on the
Tom Clancy.
Shelves. Not Tom Clancy.
Not Tom Clancy, but one of the people that licensed his name for a low-grade spy.
Exactly. Ludlum. No. John Le Carre, Tinker Tailor.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So, yeah.
Interesting choice. And
I'm interested in, you know, because this is sort of his books are kind of an important text for how we think about the Cold War and the tensions between the East and the West. And I'm really interested in talking about that with you and the novel. I've read The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, but I haven't read Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. So
cool. All right, listeners, you've been listening to the Book Spider podcast, in which this episode we discovered that literature does in fact contain some truth. It does have a relationship, whatever that relationship is, to morality. And Hans and Chris are wrong about intentionality. And no, we didn't discover that. We discovered that intentionality is a complex thing that we probably maybe need to pay attention to sometimes and then not others. And we probably need to think in creative modes all the time. So next time we're going to talk about Chris's pick, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy by John Le Carre, which I've never read, so I'm super interested. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Peace out until next time.